From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Creative industries are booming in Georgia. Film, television, music, art, and digital entertainment pumped $62.5 billion and 200,000 jobs into the economy in 2017. That's the last year tallied by Georgia's Economic Development Department and Council for the Arts. Well, at the end of this long, contentious, and sadly violent week, we are looking for inspiration and finding out more about some of the imaginative folks who make the creative economy possible. Susanna Specia is Executive Director of Reimagine ATL. Hello, Susanna.
Hello.
Did I get the last name pronunciation
right? You said it right. Yay.
Okay, good.
No one ever does.
We're in radio. And Mitch Martin is here. He's Senior Director of Creative for BMI. Hello, Mitch.
Good morning.
All right. And Jason Hoke is here. He's Head of New Initiatives and Executive Producer for How Stuff Works. Hello.
Good morning.
How are y'all?
Doing great.
Well, good. Jason, I want to start with you because How Stuff Works started in 1998, which in podcasting is like ancient history, right? Now it's a powerhouse. You produce the Atlanta Monster, huge podcast, Stuff You Missed in History Class. How many podcasts are you producing?
So we have, I think it's about 50 or 60 on the slate. That's about double what it was a year ago.
Wow.
And the audience is about 60 to 70 million downloads a month. That's an audience of about 5 or 6 million unique listeners. Pretty incredible.
So what do you do as the head of new initiatives?
So in that role, I talk to a lot of our big partners, Apple and Spotify and Pandora and the like, about really getting our content out there and getting them kind of the previews of what might be coming down the pipeline. And then as executive producer, I run a slate of shows. So we are actually following up Atlanta Monster with an additional season on Zodiac, believe it or not.
The Zodiac Killer?
Yes. 50 years later.
That should be interesting.
And a whole other bunch of goodies that will come out very soon.
So Mitch, in your business, mm-hmm. BMI started in 1939, so a long time ago for creative industries. You personally have worked with Outkast, Janelle Monáe. What does BMI actually do?
BMI is the conduit between the creators of music and those platforms that use their music. So we collect licensing fees from platforms, from digital platforms, live performance venues, radio, television, and we pay those fees that we collect out to the composers, the writers, and publishers who own the copyright.
So making sure artists get paid.
100%.
Which, of course, is getting more complicated in the digital and streaming universe.
Yeah, for sure.
How did you get started in the business?
Well, I started, like many in this business, as an intern. I interned at the legendary LaFace Records in college and went on to intern at various studios in the city. After graduating college, I worked for Outkast as office manager and eventually as an A&R.
I'm just trying to imagine Outkast office manager.
Yeah, well, it was more tame than you might think. it was a day gig, and you know, it went into the studio as the evening went on. But yeah, it was a lot of fun, and of course, being an Atlanta native and growing up on their music, it was kind of a dream job to start off with. Yeah, for sure.
Susanna, you are all about widening the circle of artists who are getting paid. A big part of your work at Reimagine ATL is focusing on equipping teens with skills. How do you all do that?
Well, our whole model is that if the industry isn't engaged in making email introductions, mentoring, giving job shadowing opportunities, then these teens aren't going to really go anywhere in the industry. That's just kind of the case for a lot of spaces. But when it comes to film, media, digital media, music, that's usually how it goes, is you have to know people, you have to intern like Mitch did. And so our entire model is built on asking corporate marketing departments, advertising, film studios, productions happening, musicians to come out and engage and teach our kids what they do. So our students actually are making their own original content as well as taking workshops and learning from the best people.
Well, this is a big issue in a city with the highest income inequality gap. Who has not been a part of this creative economy boom? Anyone want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I think you can drive around Atlanta and you can see tall buildings and amazing new developments. But if you actually really spend the time, and we did a little bit of this during the series Atlanta Monster, you drive to places where it's pretty clear that there's a different city, that there's different levels of poverty happening and different levels of access. And so part of that is being able to bring those people into the stories and hopefully lift them up. And I think we just need to do more of that.
I spoke with a colleague, Floyd Hall, about what life is like for artists, in visual artists primarily, and creative, you know, other kind of creative artists, not necessarily in the digital media fold. And he said he grew up in College Park and he never knew anyone who was a stockbroker. So how do you pursue a job if you've never seen anybody who models this? Certainly in Atlanta, there are people who know that, you know, Donald Glover is doing it, or, you know, 2 Chainz is doing it. All of these kind of artists, they have some sense of it. But how do they get into a business? How do they get into an industry not really having that inside track, not really having maybe even the knowledge of where you intern? Susanna, you look like you're ready to say something.
Yeah, I think that's why the job shadowing and, you know, internships are so important. But also what is really just a great opportunity for the creative scene in Atlanta right now is that because of the demand for more and more and more digital content, more than ever, it's an opportunity for kids and for adults who have these skill sets to get in, because creativity doesn't discriminate. We're all born with all different variations of how we view the world and perceptions. And if you can translate that into a story, into a digital form in today's world, and you have connections, you know, hey, I've seen these people do it. Atlanta is trying to make more opportunities right now around that space. We actually can start solving some of the income inequality. But that also means that we have to be paying people what they deserve. And you're talking about a heavy freelance community. Mm-hmm. And freelance, again and again, I mean, I'm around it. I'm part of that space too. We don't always know what we're valued at. And sometimes people are getting, well, all the time, constantly cut out by corporations or groups that might not be paying the rates that they should be paying. But you have to remember, if this is someone's livelihood, we need to not be asking them to do it for free. This is a skill set they're bringing and a lot of marketing value for whatever you're asking them to do.
So for Mitch, in your business, you're making sure that artists get paid. You have those relationships. Mm-hmm. Freelancers, independents often don't have that kind of thing. How do you bring them into the fold?
Well, there's a lot of community-facing initiatives that we take part in at BMI. They're going to speak to students at schools and colleges, holding showcases, myself participating on panels, going out into the community and educating them about not just the nuts and bolts of how BMI operates, but also the different opportunities and different people that exist within this city that they have access to.
Mm-hmm. Mitch Martin is Senior Director of Creative at BMI. Also with me, Susanna Spezia. She's Executive Director of Reimagine ATL. Jason Hoke is here. He's Head of Initiatives and Executive Producer of How Stuff Works. We're just getting a sense of what people do. You know, we see so many people, this economy growing. We hear about it. Who is behind it? What do they do? This is the whole idea that in the world there are flowers and there are gardeners, you know, the creatives that are blooming and out there and visible. But then there is the support people who till the soil that allows them to grow. Which are you, Mitch?
I consider myself both. I kind of pride myself on being able to go into the studio with a producer, with an artist, and give them exact feedback on, hey, maybe we should add this instrument. Maybe we should bring this up or that down in the mix. Maybe we should collaborate with that person. But also being a connector in the community and connecting creatives to one another and to other organizations that may be able to help facilitate their career. So I play in both worlds, and I kind of always have, especially, you know, the role of an A&R kind of is that. And so that's kind of my background. So I've always.
Yeah, I wonder if it's time to that model is outdated, because it takes a lot of really creative people in order to be support. I don't know. What do you think, Jason? You work with a lot of creative people.
Yeah, it's something that actually people have been starting to ask me the last couple of years. You know, maybe I'm an industry guy, and maybe that's been my background growing up in digital media for over 20 years. But I have to say, as I've gotten into more of the creative space and getting out there and talking to people and sitting down with someone for 3, 4, or 5 hours, it is absolutely one of the most addicting things that you can do. And it's just, it becomes an obsession almost. And you go down a rabbit hole and you do research and you can't stop. And I have to say, so for me, it's a little bit of a reinvention as I've kind of gotten, you know, down that rabbit hole. And it's fascinating. And so I want to do more of that. And some of that will be behind the scenes, and some of it may be in front of the mic. I don't know. It's pretty fun, though.
Yeah. Well, in front of the mic today, anyway. And I know you do a lot of that work in other places. But I'm also wondering about, like, what does the city do to nurture? I've seen all kinds of grants and initiatives in order to help entrepreneurs. But there is such a strong market in the creative industries. So many people coming in to take these jobs. Sometimes those forces just dictate themselves. Do you think the city of Atlanta, Susanna, and Georgia are doing enough to really nurture those people?
No.
In short.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of conversations happening, and there are certain things that we're doing as a city and state, but there's a lot more we could do. And I think looking at where the freelance economy is moving and how many people are freelance, it's taking up a bulk of our job market. And I think that is something that companies should be prioritizing. And there is, for the city of Atlanta, well, Invest Atlanta started a new fund. They're going to open up soon. That's for its creative industries fund. So it's a loan, which is a downside for a lot of content creators because, well, you don't know if it's going to pay off yet. But it's really flexible. So I think that's a good start. And it's kind of an experiment to see how this goes. I know that people like Jason and people like Mitch are absolutely necessary for, and they're doing this to mentor, to create more opportunities, be proactive within their seats to find those creatives and bring them up. But at the end of the day, it's going to take people, not big entities and state institutions. We are the ones who have to move it and to bring change.
Right. So for you as creatives working in this world, do you think, Mitch, I mean, you talked about some of the things you do in the community.
I agree with Susanna to an extent. I think the people are the ones who are already pushing for the creative community to be accepted and brought more to the forefront. I can say from the music sector, I think that Atlanta and Georgia as a whole need to kind of look itself in the mirror and accept I'm a music city. I'm a music city.
Yes.
And I'm a hip hop city, because you have cities like Nashville and even Memphis, New Orleans, that when you fly into the city, the airport, there are pictures of guitars and saxophones and people playing music. And I think Atlanta has to really accept that that is a major part of its identity, not just nationally, but internationally, and start to include that in its branding. And I think it needs to be messaged from government in the same way that those other cities champion a message that music is a proud part of their identity. So I think until it accepts that it is largely a music city, and I don't know that they'll really move to really put its arm around the music industry in the same way that it has, say, the film industry.
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet. You know, I'm really happy y'all were here. You're beginning our weekend in a way that we can think about creativity and imagination. I really want to thank Jason Hoke, Mitch Martin, and Susanna Specia for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, an illegal journey, a court battle, and the origins of South Georgia's Gullah Geechee community. A new documentary uncovers the story of the wanderer. Stay with us. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1858, a slave ship, the Wanderer, overloaded with more than 480 Africans, landed just off of Georgia's coast at Jekyll Island. It was 50 years since the U.S. prohibited importation of slaves. Its inhumane and horrendous journey contributed to the origin story of Georgia's Gullah Geechee community. A documentary premiering November 13th on GPB tells the story of The Wanderer, a 90-plus foot racing yacht used to import slaves from Africa to Georgia.
After about 43 days, The Wanderer reached the coast of Georgia. Corey dropped anchor about 100 to 200 yards off the beach of Jekyll Island. They started to ferry the Africans to the shore. And when all was said and done, 409 Africans were landed. So about 80 died on the passage over.
I am joined by filmmaker John Weatherford. He is also, Tyler Bagwell is also a filmmaker who worked on it, and an associate professor at the College of Coastal Georgia. John Weatherford's in the studio. Hello.
Good morning.
And Tyler is on the line with us. Hello, Tyler.
Good morning.
And also Griffin Lotson. He is joining the conversation from Jekyll Island. He is a descendant of those carried by the Wanderer. And Griffin, so great to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So, John, first, what did the Wanderer look like? This was a yacht. It was a racing schooner.
Absolutely so. It started out its life in the New York Yacht Club, and it was a racing ship. And that's what got the attention of Charlie Lamar of Savannah, who came up with the scheme to turn it into a slave ship because it was fast. And that's what everybody wanted, because Charlie wanted to take a ship that would be very, very fast. It was about a 43-day voyage at the time to get back from Congo to Jekyll Island. And he was packing as many Africans into the ship as he possibly could, 16 inches of space per person for 43 days to get them back. And the notion was he wanted to keep the fewest number possible from dying. So that's why he wanted a fast ship.
Was the boat disguised to transport slaves?
It wasn't disguised, but they kept the, it's technically called a bergee, the pennant of the New York Yacht Club. They kept that on the ship, and they had the full New York Yacht Club attire. And when they would take the ship around off the coast of Georgia and off the East Coast, they would leave those New York Yacht Club trappings on the ship so that people thought they were just sailing around having a grand time. But again, Charlie was broke. He needed to get money, and the scheme he came up to get money with was he'll go over, fill the ship up with African captives, bring them back to the U.S. and sell them as slaves.
Well, it was a really lucrative trade at that point, the domestic slave trade. But Tyler, how about the people who were on board? John mentioned that they were from Congo. How were they kidnapped in Africa?
Well, it looks like through tribal wars. And basically, there would be slave traders on the coast, and other African tribes would have wars. And then this is one way, of course. And they would then, the losers of the battle, of course, became slaves, and they were brought to the coast. And then, of course, they were sold from, in our case, the Congo River.
So it must have been horrific, as described, 487 people packed onto this boat. And when it reached Jekyll Island, people were dispersed, but 40, I think, from if I remember correctly from the documentary, were left on the island. Now, Griffin, is this a revelation to you? How much did you know about the Wanderer and your own family's history?
Yes, earlier... I did not know much at all. It was through one of my relatives, Amy Lotson Roberts, that sent me down the rabbit hole. And once I get a little bit of information, then I do all the research I can. So it was exhilarating on one end, maybe sad on another, that my journey started in such a horrific way.
Well, you are a member of this Gullah Geechee community. What is the connection between the Wanderer and the Gullah Geechee people? Some of them stayed there, lived there, built families there, and contributed to this culture?
Oh, yes. Well, the uniqueness, of course, of the Gullah Geechee Quarter, as we call it, fortunately or unfortunately, we all landed here because of our very special skills. We know how to deal with agriculture, and the slave masters, they couldn't handle those mosquito bites quite as well as we could, so we could survive. And we had absentee landlords a lot. So in other words, when the mosquitoes were real bad, they went back up to Philadelphia, and we had to rough it down here. So the connection, we develop our own style. Like we might say things like, "Ha ana fadu, come ya disha that day." I know exactly what I'm saying. It's English, but some of our patois are a mixture of our own African language from Africa, which we still retain today. So this is great that more people learn about this history.
What did you just say?
Well, Hahana Fadu is what, when you would say good morning, first thing we would say, Hahana Fadu, when you walk up to the door. And that's it. Things like, come Yadisha that day, of course, I would say, come here. And if I had something in my hand, it would say, come Yad, then that day. If I say it that day, I'm holding it. And so it's kind of just a language. We know exactly what we say. And if I was talking with another Gullah Geechee, it would be very easy. And, of course, often when we're in meetings, a lot of people do exactly what you did. They'll whisper to their neighbor and say, what did they say?
That is Griffin Lawton. He's a descendant of a person who was carried to the United States on the Wanderer from Africa, a slave ship that landed on the coast of Georgia back in 1858. Also with us, Tyler Bagwell and John Weatherford. They produced a documentary about the ship, and it's going to air on GPB next Tuesday, the 13th. Now, Tyler, the Wanderer was operating when the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, was illegal in the U.S., but domestic slave trade very lucrative. The Emancipation Proclamation didn't come until 1863. So why did the traders who ran the Wanderer end up on trial?
Ooh, good question. Well, they were eventually discovered, and three of the crewmen were actually arrested, and they went to trial. But of course, the trial, they were acquitted, and then it was the start of the Civil War. But they did have a trial. Even the yacht was confiscated by the government. It was actually used for a time during the Civil War. In later years, it was carrying fruit and actually sunk off the coast of Cuba. But the trial was a big story. It was announced around the world via the telegraph. So it was a big trial, but of course, the three crewmen were acquitted.
So, John, I understand that President James Buchanan himself got involved with this high-profile trial. What did he do?
Absolutely. Buchanan came to Buchanan's attention, so he sent down the Attorney General of the United States to be involved in the trial. There also was a Justice of the Supreme Court as well. So it was, as Tyler says, about as high-profile as you could get. But there's this wonderful soundbite in there from Vonette Good Walker, who's just a marvelous and wonderful woman. She does tours around the Savannah area. And she said that all of this happened over a year. And as she kind of laughs to herself, a lot can happen in a year in Savannah. The ship disappears, the slaves disappear, the evidence disappears. And as Tyler says, everybody went scot-free. Charlie Lamar never faced justice for this. The three crewmen who were jailed for it went free. It was a verdict of not guilty.
What happened to all of those who were, 400 odd who landed on Jekyll Island?
Jim Jordan, who's one of the folks interviewed in the book and an historian, talks about it. There was a group that went up into South Carolina. There was a group that he thinks went over to the Satilla River. And then, as you indicated, there were about 40 or so who remained in Georgia. And it's really those 40 or so people who we have the greatest opportunity to find anything about. We're now at the place where it's kind of the great-great-grandchildren. And as we identified in the documentary, the famous NFL star and actor Jim Brown was a great-great-grandson of a Wanderer captive. A woman who was the first African-American woman on the Supreme Court in Nassau County in New York was a great-great-granddaughter. The Double Mint Twins from that advertising campaign. And then we've got our very own wonderful Griffin Lawton, who, as I discovered yesterday for the first time, played a part in Roots, which I didn't know about.
What was that, Griffin?
Yeah, that was very exciting. I told him I would have worked for free the opportunity to work with Roots and its rich history. Basically, I work with a group, and it's called the Geechee Gullah Ring Shouters. We headquarters out of Darien, Georgia, McIntosh County, which you might be familiar with, the famous Weeping Time, which is similar to the Wanderer. And so through that, they needed someone to give the real history of how the ring shout was conducted on the plantations. And out of the millions of people on this planet, they called me, and we choreographed that full scene when Kuta Kinte was escaping the very first time and the ring shout was performed. So it was a historical moment for me, a legacy for my kids, my grandkids, and for the world long after I'm dead and gone, that history will be there of how the Africans did the ring shout, and we kept it alive here in America on the plantations.
Well, Griffin, I'm guessing that they called you because you are an historian of this culture and a great interpreter and teller of this tale. But I understand that at one time you wanted your identity, your Gullah Geechee identity, concealed. You didn't talk about it. You didn't tell people about it. Why?
Yeah, I at first, when I was a young person, I did not know it was others just like me. And after being an adult, Clarence Thomas is about 6 years older than myself, and I heard about him. I've met him, and we have talked as Gullah Geechees, and that was refreshing. He laid aside all of that professionalism, and we just what we call chew the fat. And he, too, had the same problem, which was you were considered unlearned. You could not get ahead in life if you were Gullah Geechee. So I started practicing to sing my words like I'm from New York. Like I would say, how are you doing? Well, this is a very lovely day. So I practiced not to say, come ya de sha that day, and my words slip out. I still try to talk proper, but everybody asks me, where you from? And then I chuckle, and because I'm Gullah Geechee, descendant of West Africa. So, yes, we pretty much wanted to disown it. Now, both Clarence Thomas and myself, we embrace it because you should never be ashamed of your culture.
Well, you mentioned the story of the weeping time. What can you tell us about the connection between the wanderer and the weeping time? This is largest sale of human beings ever in the United States.
Yes, both from nearby islands. You have Jekyll Island, then you have St. Simon Island, and you have Darien, Georgia. That's where I'm from, McIntosh County, and we keep that history alive. Perhaps some of those 40s that were left perhaps was traded off to one of the butlers. And my understanding, as I'm learning from John and others, is that the wanderer had money problems, and the same thing happened to Pierce Butler. He had a lot of debt, so he sold all of these families, and there's some beautiful stories how people were torn apart and never saw their families again, and those that wanted to get married. And I've been in plays for the same reason as you said, the movie Roots, because of the history I bring. So, yes, the tie-in is close. I have not done the research to see whether any of that 40 was sold off to the Butler Plantation, but it's a possibility. And that was a horrific time. Ann Bailey did a book called Weeping Time Now in depicting some of this real-life history.
Yeah, I understand. There was the rain just poured down on that day. John, yeah. You're nodding.
Yeah, one of the other people who's involved in this, Dr. Felicia Bell, who's interviewed in the documentary, who's now heading up the Rosa Parks Museum down in Montgomery for Troy, was very, very focused on the same story. And they are very parallel because Charlie Lamar got involved in this wanderer scheme because he was broke, as Jim Jordan says. And the same situation occurred, as Griffin was saying, with this other gentleman out of the Southeast. He had real money problems. He owed a lot of people a lot of money, and his scheme was to sell over 400 slaves in a given weekend. They did it over the weekend. The heavens opened up. The rains poured down, and everybody said it was kind of sympathetic weeping from the heavens to go along with the weeping from all of those more than 400 slaves who were being, families were being torn apart. They would, mothers and children, husbands and wives, they would never see each other again. It's a horrible, horrible time. It took place down at a racetrack just below Savannah that doesn't exist anymore. But Dr. Bell was talking about the possibility of maybe doing a documentary to focus on that story because, again, both of them arose out of money and the need for money fast.
Well, I guess there are no end of subjects for documentaries for you here in Georgia. But, John, just wondering, we've got half a minute left.
Earlier this year, Zora Neale Hurston's book about Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo that came over on the Clotilde and crashed, went aground at Mobile Bay. So how did the books like hers and documentaries like yours change the way that we consider the history of race and oppression here in the U.S.?
Well, that's hopefully why we did the documentary in the first place. These are certainly interesting times we're in these days. This was a horrible story that took place 160 years ago. We're hoping when people see it that they'll go, we don't need to do this again. We don't need to treat people like that. No. So we're hopeful.
John Weatherford, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Tyler Bagwell, thank you.
Thank you.
John and Tyler are producers of a documentary about the ship The Wanderer, airs on GPB this coming Tuesday, November 13th. Griffin Lotson, such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're hearing a 1926 recording of Kumbaya as sung by a Gullah Geechee man. His name was H. Wiley. First known recording of the song. Coming up, Rick Grimes is off The Walking Dead, TV show at least. We're going to speak with Kalina Buller, host of The Credits, when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Sunday, people across the world are marking 100 years since the armistice that ended World War I in 1918. On 11/11 at 11 a.m. in your own time zone, you're invited to ring bells or wind chimes or church steeples in the town square or improvise any instrument or mobile phone app to mark that. And we will be commemorating that and Veterans Day Monday on our show. We're going to be learning about what was known as the war to end all wars affected the lives and people of Georgia and the South, and explore a whole new field of research into how African Americans, so often left out of official histories, were impacted. So make sure and join us for that on Monday, or you can listen on your own time from gpbnews.org and our app. If you haven't seen the latest episode of The Walking Dead, we're going to warn you, this may contain spoilers. The show is filmed in Georgia and entered a new chapter last Sunday. Andrew Lincoln made his exit from The Walking Dead, but AMC has not yet finished telling the story of Rick Grimes. Producers plan to write and produce spinoffs that star Lincoln. Now, the characters are only one part of the show's success. The props also make up a huge part. Kalina Buller is a friend of On Second Thought and host of The Credits. That is a new podcast from GPB that debuts today. And here's just a taste. Kalina's speaking here with The Walking Dead props assistant Danny Gorbachev for The Credits. He got his start in the film industry in a small production company in North Carolina.
When North Carolina voted away all the tax incentives, we were looking for someplace else to go. Being from the Atlanta area seemed like a good fit. It was an art PA for about 3 years and really enjoyed it, learned a whole lot, and just recently, a couple months ago, decided to make the leap and join the union and get into props, which is kind of where I always wanted to be. So I've liked to be hands-on, and I'm also very detail-oriented and sort of keeping track of, you know, my brain just sort of works well in that fashion, or kind of clocking where things were, you know, little kind of what could be considered nitpicky things, but for that world are very important, you know, for the sake of continuity and so on. You don't want it to stick out. In a way, if it's hardly noticed, it's kind of a good thing because it means, you know, it looked as it should have. And, just recently I've been day playing on The Walking Dead. For a props person, it's been a dream, you know, because everybody's got their knives and their guns and we're covering things in blood. And, you know, there's a whole lot of background that also need all their props and, you know, their weapons or bows or what have you, you know, axes, all these little different things. That Rick Grimes Magnum, that's pretty iconic, and the Lucille, the barbed wire bloody bat. It's a big show for the props department, which is, you know, it's a lot of fun for me to be in that environment because I can learn a lot while I'm there. I'm still, you know, very early on in you know, as a my career as a props assistant, so for me there's still lots to learn, and that's been really great. And I can't get over seeing zombies, like, smoking cigarettes at, you know, at lunchtime, and so there's just something very fun about that, you know, having a smoke. Working with a really on-point, super tight-knit group like they have over at The Walking Dead has been a dream, and that's really been great, too, just sort of seeing people you know, at their A game and kind of learning from those folks has been great. For me, too, nothing's too specific. I would say I'm a big history nerd, so a big period piece also as a props person, I would really be into that. To keep things in perspective, I mean, I really do feel lucky. I feel like we're all very lucky to get to do what we do.
Danny Gorbachev, props assistant for The Walking Dead, speaking with Kalina Buller, host of The Credits, and she is here in the studio with us to give the rundown on The Walking Dead and other productions here in Georgia. First, Kalina, congratulations.
Thank you so much, and good morning.
So great to hear that. So, just curious, that little bell that went off, is that like something that happens on a film set,
bell? Right.
It's like calling you to school?
Essentially, it's a warning. So it's letting people know, hey, we are rolling or getting ready to roll. And it's usually accompanied with a blinking red light. And you see that a lot on sound stages when people are filming, because there's lots of commotion going on behind the scenes. And we want to hold all work, as we say, when that bell goes off and that light starts blinking. So
great to get a little insight on that. And great to hear your interview from the set of The Walking Dead. And we know characters take on different roles and identities in productions, but I guess props are also playing their own kind of role. I mean, think of Rosebud.
Yeah.
And the whole Chekhov thing that if a gun goes off in the third act, gun is pictured in the third act, it's going to go off by the end of the play.
Right.
So how do they make sure these things get seen?
I think that each character, a prop is an extension of your character. So there is an entire department dedicated to it, because some of these characters have, you know, these practical items that they use, that whether they're weapons or if there is a person who is a chef and they have a particular, you know, item that they use to, like a spatula or a butcher's knife or something, or a cleaver if you're
in The Walking Dead.
You're right, The Walking Dead. And these items, by extension, they become iconic. And so you have to have people that are doing the research, of course, that make sure that these items are not just specific to the character, but also specific to the time.
Mm-hmm. Feel accurate.
Exactly.
Like you said, the nitpicky things, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and Danny touched on that when we talked to him on the set. And he was just in awe as he got to see these items that they've already become iconic. But in the beginning, first season, unless you were a fan of the graphic novel, you didn't necessarily know about, Rick and his particular props or Michonne and her katana, you know, things like that. So it was, I'm sure it was an amazing experience for him just getting started. And I know for a lot of people, it's just something that it's almost like akin to how, like a wand for a fairy or something like that. You just, if you see a fairy or a witch or something like that, you have to have a wand somewhere nearby.
Yeah.
It's just, it goes with the character.
Right. And I imagine for the actor, they maybe become it, become
exactly.
The part when they hold on to this bat or whatever.
Exactly.
Well, you describe The Credits as your love letter to the hardworking people alongside you in the industry. So what are some of the other stories that we can expect from The Credits?
We are going to hear some great stories. One in particular that I loved was the story that I told or got to tell for a friend of mine named Stephanie Morales. She does craft services. And what craft services is, essentially, is the people that walk around with the snack trays on set, and they make sure that everybody is satiated and feels, full, and they're able to focus on the job, because no one wants to necessarily have a growling stomach or a tummy that's empty when they're trying to lift, all kinds of equipment.
I would be so much more effective if I didn't have to think about making dinner.
And we also found out, talking to her, that it's more than just bringing out the snacks. She's essentially somebody that you can break with. Mm. You can go to her truck, sit down, she'll hand you a bowl of something delicious, or, you can crack open a bag of chips or something, and she will talk to you and clear your head so you can get back out there and do the job you were paid to do.
You also spoke with Joel Ray Ishman and Quaylen Bradley. Both are stand-in actors there on FX's Atlanta.
That's right.
Here's just a little preview of that episode.
I found that stand-in work, not only is it stable for you, like, financially, so you have, right, as an artist, it's important to have that foundation. It's also such a great learning experience. You learn so much that you would never learn from, you know, a class. Coming from theater, you learn so many different types of methods of acting. However, when you are on film and TV, those methods don't translate.
Kalina, do you find that, can you tell if somebody's been a theater-trained actor compared to a sort of film and TV actor?
There's an adage out there that says if you are maybe a stand-up comedian, you can easily transition to being an actor, but actors can't necessarily become comedians. And I think there's something that has something to do with being able to stand up and speak publicly.
Yeah.
And when you are a screen actor exclusively, sometimes that's a little bit more difficult because you can have a little bit more of an intimate relationship with the camera than you can with a general audience that's, you know, just wide and huge and big. And there's something about projection and being able to gesture with arms and hands, you know. But at the end of the day, everybody needs specific training. And I think stand-ins in particular, they have to not only be trained in the craft of acting, they kind of have to know the science behind filmmaking. They need to know that, oh, if I stand X amount of feet away from this camera, this angle will look this way, because these are the questions that the director and the assistant director are asking of them. You know, so they're standing in so they can get the technical aspects together for the actors that will come in and actually do the roles. So the stand-in actors are on another league entirely. And that was something I was not prepared for. As someone who's done this for about 14 years, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So, yes.
That's a surprise to me. Do they have to learn the scripts? Do they have
Absolutely.
To stand there all day? I mean, they're working all day alongside
they
all the actors?
They are all day, yes. And they're not just with the actors, but they're part of the crew. And that's what I think people don't understand, too, about stand-in actors is, yes, they are acting in a way, but they're really the crew members. They are the people that are making the movie magic happen. And you may not see them necessarily on screen, but you feel the work that they did because the actors have perfect, you know, they're standing just where they need to stand and they are moving just where they need to move in relation to the camera and in relation to the characters, the other characters they're working with and the set and everything. So, yeah. It's very technical, much more technical than I was prepared for.
Well, we're getting a real glimpse of that with Kalina Buller. She's host of the Credits podcast and talking about what's next for The Walking Dead, among other things, and talk about her new podcast that is launching today on GPB. But while we have you here, we have to ask you, what's filming in Georgia? One recent entertainment announcement had fans in a little bit of shock. Tyler Perry says his next Madea film will be his last. Here is a clip from the most recent A Madea Family Funeral.
The Bible say, yea, though she walked in the valley with the shadow of Little Red Riding Hood and the three bears, she feared no evil because the three little pigs was not around.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. She's just iconic. She will be missed.
Will she be missed? I mean, has she run out of gas? I mean, why do you think Tyler Perry is doing this?
I'm not sure his reasons for doing it, but I think all good things essentially have to come to an end. Many of us out here in the audience, we had a love-hate relationship with Madea. Some of us were really, really into her. We said, oh, yes, that reminds me of the women in my family, particularly the older women in my family. Some of us were like, oh, no, this is some kind of like minstrel caricature. This is not going to work. And we can come up from this. And, you know, there was arguments on both sides. But you cannot deny the iconic nature of this character and what he has brought to the screen. And oh my gosh, what my Halloween, what's it going to be like without Madea? What is my Christmas going to be like without Madea? Even though I personally am not a fan of the characters per se, it just, you know, you knew a Madea movie was coming out, you know, at least once or twice a year. It became a staple. So, yeah, she'll be missed.
Well, I'm thinking that, you know, in the Madea movies, a man plays a woman. Mm-hmm. And the first one was made in 2005. But since then,
understanding, respect for the transgender community has come a long way.
Absolutely.
I wonder if that evolution in thinking is part of what's bringing this franchise to a close.
I'm sure. I think audiences, as we have gone on from the days of the Nickelodeon, I mean, we are becoming smarter viewers, right? And so we want to see more authenticity. And I think there can be still a place for people playing characters that aren't necessarily their gender. But I think going forward, characters like Madea are going to start, they may start falling off. I think we'll see them, you know, throughout film and television as we keep going, but it's not going to be
the star.
Know, very prominent like it was, I think.
Just Mercy is being filmed in Atlanta, starring Michael B. Jordan, Jamie Foxx, and Brie Larson. It's a biopic of the late work of Bryan Stevenson. Now, this is the man who initiated the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery.
That's right.
Honoring lynching victims, and has also worked on a number of cases helping to exonerate people falsely accused. Here he is speaking with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! About mass incarceration.
We now live in an era of mass incarceration where we intimidate and threaten and harass and menace people of color. And these, everybody feels it. And so we shouldn't be surprised if you don't get justice. What we should do is start talking about truth.
That's a pretty, let's say, heated or almost a flashpoint contemporary political issue right now. Is it a challenge for turning Hollywood star power on issues like this?
Not anymore.
Yeah.
It used to be, maybe, but not anymore. I think, like I said, when I said earlier, the audience is getting a little smarter. We're also getting a lot more cognizant that we're all human, including our celebrities that we love so much. And we also want to know what their political views are. And so it's almost expected, as we can see from this past election cycle in the midterms, people got upset that Beyoncé didn't come out for Beto O'Rourke because, you know, earlier, instead of the day before. So I think that with celebrities starting to do more of these biopics, it's just going to be par for the course at this point. We have a lot of major issues in our country at the moment, and mass incarceration is one of them. Being falsely accused and spending time in jail or prison falsely is a huge problem, particularly in the Black community. And so Bryan Stevenson's story is outstanding. And if anybody like me had a chance to read his book, Just Mercy, I'm very excited for this film. I'm excited for what Michael B. Jordan's trying to do as a producer. And I'm excited for that cast. You know, it's just going to be amazing. I can't say it enough. I'm very excited about it.
Well, not entirely dissimilar trailer for Best of Enemies just released. This is coming out in 2019. Taraji P. Henson and Sam Rockwell in the new movie based on another true story book, The Best of Enemies. Story here about local KKK, somebody who, an unlikely friendship, let's put it that way.
Yes.
So do you think we're going to see, have to wrap in just a second,
of course,
but more of those, you know, things that adults can handle.
Right. We can handle things where there's redemption at the end. Because even though in Best of Enemies, from the trailer and from the book, it's a story of an unlikely friendship between a civil rights activist and a Ku Klux Klan leader in Durham, North Carolina, you got to think about that we can all still come together at the end to do what's right. And I think that's a message of hope. And I, for one, worked on that film. So this is going to be great.
Congratulations. And a message of hope indeed. Kalina Buller, she's host of GPB's The Credits Podcast, which you can start listening to today.
Absolutely.
And that is it. We're so glad to have you with us on this Friday. Have a beautiful weekend. I'm Virginia Prescott. For me and all the crew here at On Second Thought, thanks so much for spending time.